Hello and welcome to the Argetta Named London Theatre Podcast for the 10th of September 2017. My name's TRB Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, Paul in London, and Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Goer. We're now going to talk about Follies at the Olivier, part of the National Theatre. This is Stephen Sondheim's 1971 musical with a book by James Goldman. It's directed here by Dominic Cook and choreographed by Bill Deemer. It stars Imelda Staunton, Philip Quast, Janie D, Tracy Bennett, Dawn Hope, the Botcher, Geraldine Fitzgerald, and Peter Forbes, amongst a very large cast. I think the full cast runs to 37 people. We are at a Ziegfeld Follies-like theatre in late 60s or early 1970s, where they have brought back some of the dancers from around about 30 years before, and in some cases 50 years before. We're talking about, I think they go back as far as 1919, or even before the First World War. What happens is the former showgirls gather, they talk, and they will sing a number. So for different periods, they will sing a different number. But at the centre are four characters, Buddy and Sally Plummer, and Benjamin and Phyllis Stone. Sally and Phyllis were showgirls. They were great friends back in the 1940s when they met Ben and Buddy. And we really focus on their relationships with the other characters coming in to provide their own songs and in many cases showstoppers. Follies is very famous for having a very large number of showstopping songs, things that have become standards like Broadway Baby, Losing My Mind, I'm Still Here, Too Many Mornings, and Could I Leave You. This seems to be one of the musicals that most people have been really looking forward to coming along. It was very difficult to get, for some people to get tickets to this production, because we're basically throwing, you know, every major musical star we can find from a British point of view at this musical. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Even though it was written and first staged in 1971, we didn't actually see it in London until 1987. It had been up into the northwest, to Wythenshawe, I think, but its first West End outing was quite some time after New York. And it was Cameron McIntosh that actually put it on, and he insisted in some changes, not least of which was to put in an interval, which they hadn't done in New York. And it was a very good London cast, because it had Diana Rigg in the role of Phyllis that Jane Indeed now has, Judy McKenzie in the role that Imelda Staunton now has, and Daniel Massey and David Healy in the two roles of the lead men. And it did very well in London. It actually ran longer in London than it did in New York, even though it is actually quintessentially a very American show. But I think the reason we haven't seen it since then is probably because of the resources it requires to put it on. Because, as you say, it's got not just an enormous cast, but it's also got an enormous band. And it does need to have a staging, you know, that allows them to recreate the Follies themselves, as well as the dilapidated theatre they're in today, and so on. It's a show that I've never found to be my favourite Sondheim show, even though it does contain some of his best songs. A Little Night Music and Follies have been the two shows that, for me, when I saw them, and to some extent with A Little Night Music when I've seen it since, have always seemed a bit conventional and untouched old-fashioned. So even though I've liked some of the components of them, they haven't appealed as shows in the same way as Sunday in the Park with George or Pacific Overtures or Sweeney Todd, which as a whole are much more original pieces. And I saw A Little Night Music last week in Newbury, and that just wowed me, because for the first time I thought, gosh, this is a masterpiece. And here I am, just 5 days later, feeling exactly the same thing about Follies. And I think I've kind of come to the conclusion that I saw it too early, and that I've kind of grown into Follies, or that I'm ready for Follies, perhaps, because I felt very different about it last night than I have before. I did see the original West End outing, but I also have seen three much smaller scale or different productions between 2002 and 2010 in just 8 years. There were three in quick succession, because they did a semi-stage version of the Royal Festival Hall, which was directed by Paul Kerrison, who was doing great stuff in Leicester at the time. And then there was a delightful fringe production at the Landor, which shouldn't have worked but did. And then another one during Sondheim's 80th year in Walthamstow. But we haven't had an outing like this, really. And that's why I think the anticipation amongst Sondheim fans has been simply extraordinary. And I was just trying to control myself last night, because I was seriously overexcited. But it just pays off. Dominic Cooke isn't known for musicals, to be honest, and maybe that's a good thing, because the one thing that struck me about it last night is the storytelling and the acting. So, I mean, it wasn't just the music last night. I think it sort of worked as a play with music as well as it worked as a musicale. And, of course, it moves from the present time to the past, so they get to showcase big Follies numbers like Beautiful Girls and Loveland. But Loveland is a kind of pastiche where they place into it a song for each of the four lead characters that's about their folly, the other sort of meaning of folly, if you like, the folly in their life. And then you've got turns from the past where you've got numbers by, I'm thinking the original production, it was Pearl Carr and Teddy Johnson, who did the rather sort of sweet song, Rain on the Roof. And then there's another, it's a kind of medley of Rain on the Roof, Our Paris, and the medley ends with Broadway Baby, which is one of the most famous songs. And then you've got other people coming back singing the defiant I'm Still Here, which is, of course, Tracy Bennett's contribution as her character. And a couple of opera singers played here by Josephine Barstow and Alison Langer, who also do quite an extraordinary rendition of their song. So it's got so much in it. It's got big numbers. It's got kind of turns from the past. It's got what I think Sondheim calls character songs like Losing You, which are like songs in any other musical. So there's so much in it, really. It is very, very well designed by Vicky Mortimer. She's created this incredible old decaying playhouse, and it just looks wonderful. But it's the cast that make it, really. I mean, it's just, you couldn't imagine. And some of the casting is a bit unlikely, really. So, for example, you've got in the role of Buddy, you've got Peter Forbes, who isn't known, I don't think, for musical theatre that much. And I thought he was excellent. Obviously, Philip Quast is very much a musical theatre man, and Janine Dee and Melda Staunton are very much musical theatre women as well. But then you've got Di Boccia, who plays the role of Hattie, who gets to sing Broadway Baby, and I think she does the most amazing job in that. But a very unlikely piece of casting for me. And then, of course, you've got Tracy Bennett, who is known for musical theatre, who really does relish her big number, I'm Still Here, and with great, great passion. And she brought the house down as well, really. So it's just impeccably cast, beautifully designed, wonderful staging. And it's just a 2.25-hour feast, really. And by the time it got to the Loveland pastiche with the Follies in it, I was just completely overwhelmed by everything, and Losing You then started to get to me, and it became much more emotional. And it's not even 10 hours since I left the theatre. So my next job after recording this is to go and book and see it, or try and book to see it again, because it's something that will not come across again in my lifetime and has to be seen more than once. So a show I wasn't sure was a favourite has overnight become a favourite, and I think it's found its time with me. I'd be interested whether younger people going to it at the age I went to it first time round will feel the same as I did first time round, but I haven't met any to talk to yet. But if you haven't got a ticket, you should get a ticket, because it's something very, very special indeed. And only the National Theatre could frankly do it, you know, with 58 people on stage and a band and apparently 200 people involved in the production. This is something that requires resources that any West End producer would struggle to find these days. The original production, incidentally, even though it ran for somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, never made a single penny and didn't pay back a single penny of its capitalisation to its investors, but they kept it running. So that's the kind of, you know, that's the scale of this show. But it's a must, an absolute must.
I have to say I agree that this is an extremely well done production. I didn't find a single duff performance in the production I saw, and everything was, you know, really well done. There was one slight disappointment. It was mainly because I'd always heard that the only song from this that I knew was known to sort of bring the house down, raise the roof, or whichever way around we're doing it. The only song that I knew was a real showstopper was Broadway Baby, especially when sung by Elaine Stritch, which was the Lincoln Centre one done in 1985. So I was always expecting that, and it was something that she would do as well as a concert piece, and it was always something I was very impressed by. So this was the song I knew that came from here. And it's perfectly well sung by Di Boccia, but you kind of felt, well, she's not a great old stager like Elaine Stritch was when she sang it. She's not this great personality to sing that song. And I was rather disappointed in that. I mean, it's no question that Di Boccia does a very good job of it, and it's very nicely presented. But, you know, I just thought, well, isn't this meant to be special? Another problem I had with this play is really it comes down to the book, because you have this sort of central story of these four characters, Buddy, Sally, Ben and Phyllis, and you concentrate on them and maybe you lose a bit from the other characters. They don't really have a characterization, a lot of them. They're just there to present their sort of their special, whether it's Dawn, Hope, Stella, gave us what I thought felt at the time was one of the most brilliant pieces of sort of choreography and dance number that I have ever seen on stage. Now, I haven't gone to enough musicals, and it hasn't been mentioned a lot by everybody else. So clearly I've been missing out on some very good and very well staged bits of choreography. This is a piece, I think it's called Who's That Woman, where we have this troupe of dancers of all about the same vintage, and then their ghosts take over the dance halfway through. And I thought that worked extremely effectively, and it was very, very well received on the night I went. But as I said, nobody else has mentioned it. So clearly this is a commonplace thing that happens all the time in good musicals, so it wasn't worth anybody else mentioning. Another one of the parts that also stood out in the songs, one of these sort of individual showpieces, is of course Carlotta Campion singing I'm Still Here. This is done by Tracy Bennett. Now, Tracy Bennett, I've seen a few times playing Judy Garland, and I couldn't help thinking that, or wondering at least, if Carlotta Campion was sort of, I mean, obviously Judy Garland had died by the time Stephen Sondheim had written this, but I found something about Judy Garland in Tracy Bennett's performance. It may just be that association, because I've seen Tracy Bennett play Judy Garland a few times before. That worked really quite well, and that was again, we got individual pieces which are all very well done, and that one particularly was outstanding. But the problems for me came about with these main four characters when we get to the Loveland sequence. Now, on the night I went, which was a very early preview, bits of the stage broke down, which is not unexpected, but it did mean that the Loveland piece got delayed. So it gave you sort of a time to fidget and look at your programmes, and I couldn't help noticing, looking at my programme, that one of the songs coming up, Losing My Mind, it's possibly Stephen Sondheim's biggest pop hit, because it was remixed in a Pet Shop Boys manner and sung by Liza Minnelli in the 80s, and it did chart quite reasonably well. And I realised that the person who was going to sing it would be Imelda Staunton as Sally. Now, Imelda Staunton delivers the song wonderfully, but it's not Sally. And that particular thing began to bother me. I was anticipating that I wouldn't like it. And although, as I said, Imelda Staunton's fine singing this, I just didn't think that it fitted the person of Sally that we've come to know over the previous hour and a half. And I began to become really quite disappointed with that. And it was compounded not so much with what we get in the Loveland sequences. We get these follies where the main four characters each sing out what's on their mind. And as I said, the Sally one didn't kind of fit. And the final one that we get is Benjamin Stone's, the Philip Quast character. Because his is the final song in the piece, the final solo, the final showpiece song, he suddenly elevated to a point of importance that he didn't have before. He was just this rather bland character, and suddenly we're supposed to care about him, and suddenly we're supposed to empathise with what he's thinking. I just thought to myself, well, no, you haven't earned that. And it's nothing to do with the performance. It is a lot to do with the book. It's, you know, obviously to do a little bit with the choice of the way that the songs are written. And it's a sort of that inconsistency. And they're suddenly wanting me to care about Ben, suddenly wanting me to think that Sally, having been this rather emotional character, not driven by her mind, suddenly sings a song which is highly analytical or highly self-analytical, like Losing My Mind. I just didn't get it, and it was a rather disappointing feeling that sat at the back of my mind after seeing this. But obviously everything was so well done, I certainly joined into the very full applause at the end of this musical, and also we were getting standing ovations. This has been extremely strongly reviewed, and I'm not a particularly experienced musicals hand, so perhaps I'm wrong in some of these things.
But they're all four of them are flawed, though, because, I mean, she's been foolish in her sort of, her unrequited love of Buddy. And Buddy's been a philanderer, and Phyllis is acid-tongued and very cynical, and Ben is very slight. So they're all flawed characters in a way. And what I like about the Ben character is, you're right, you don't like him, you don't empathize with him, there's nothing to make you do it. But then you get to that last song. And he, all of a sudden, I think you sort of, well, to me, I then all of a sudden feel, well, they're all bad. Is he really that much worse than any of the others? But what I'd forgotten last night was actually, because when he stops the song and says, I'm sorry, I actually thought that was an error. I actually thought he'd have forgotten his lines, because I'd actually forgotten that that's part of the song. So I was sitting there thinking, oh God, we got all this way and everything's gone right. And he goes and fluffs it. And then of course, you quickly realise this is part of it. But I'd kind of, after so long, I'd kind of forgotten all of that, really. But Philip Quast is, I mean, it's one of the best things I've ever seen him do, I think. It's very, very good.
What do you think about it, Webcow Girl?
I think I need to take you out and get the boxing gloves on, is what I think, because to say that Losing My Mind is not an appropriate song for Sally, to me, indicates you did not understand her character, because her entire thing is about her obsession and her obsession for her old boyfriend, or not really boyfriend, her best friend's boyfriend, is completely mentally unhinged. There's indications in this play that Sally's actually spent some time in the funny farm, and this song is all about having an obsession take over your life. And for her to hold on to something for 30 years nearly is absolutely appropriate. And I thought that it was a beautiful song illustrating like Sally's essential unhingedness, which is the core of her character. And I'll tell you the trick that you missed, though, you complained about the wrong thing about Imelda Staunton, which is she is supposed to be playing a woman who is in her 40s, and despite the fact that she can sing and she can dance, I felt she did not really get Sally, that she did not bring Sally to life. Sally's note is craziness, but she is played so, not that that's her note, but that's her only thing. Staunton has her so brittle, so on the edge constantly. I just found it difficult to believe that she was real. And I like that in my shows. So I felt that it's possible there is a different actress out there who could bring something to this character and make her more well-rounded. And I went to see this show in part because I really love Imelda Staunton, and I think she's a fantastic actress and does well in straight theater as well as musicals. But I felt she was a weak point. That said, I feel that Follies is one of the most exquisite shows I have ever seen on the London stage. And I can say now that is in 11 years of going to the theater here. And actually, it's in 13 because I started seeing shows in London before I lived here. But I liked it so much, I went back a second time in the first week. I just rushed out and got another ticket. And that's because, as a theatrical experience, the gorgeous richness and evocativeness of the setting and the costumes, first of all, completely sucks you in to this world of the past, this world of memories. And it's a kind of space where past and present are happening simultaneously. I find this very enticing. But you add on top of that this endless series of gorgeous songs illustrating the action and making these various characters come to life. And for me, it was an almost unparalleled experience in terms of just the pure pleasure that I had while I was sitting there watching the show, which is pretty impressive if you considered I had to sit there for over 2 hours. And girlfriend, I am not built with the bladder that I had back when I was Sally's age the first time around. It is a long time to sit there, but I was pulled along with the music into the story, into this environment, into this world. And then, as I'm completely absorbed with the creation of this simultaneous music hall of the 1920s and 30s, and this rubble of building and honestly, rubble of lives that was held in front of me at the same time, then Loveland happens. Sondheim jumps the shark, everything becomes completely ridiculous. And, I push through to the crazy, crazy end. And in some way, actually, it was in that last 20 minutes that I felt like we got the real experience of what seeing a review would have been like back in those days, which I really, really loved. I was just delighted by it. And, I had not heard Losing My Mind before I saw this show, because I have to say I didn't really care for the Pet Shop Boys back in the 80s, so it wouldn't have been a thing for me. The song that I came to see that I was particularly interested in was Could I Leave You, which is hysterical and such a delicious character illustration song. But let's just kind of think about the song One More Kiss. Because you said, like, how is it that there's this other song that's supposed to be the showstopper number? And, well, it's not. And to me, this thing is full of so many beautiful pieces that when you get to, I mean, One More Kiss, when we have this, I don't know, is she an 80-year-old actress on stage simultaneously with the most amazing singer, I think, of the bunch, doing this extraordinarily nostalgic tune that was supposed to capture, say, the period around 1918 or so. I felt I was caught in this moment of ceaseless, timeless beauty. It was just so amazing. But none of us have talked about that. Nobody else has said anything about it. Once it was over, we just went on to the next incredible number. And the fact that there are so many bits like this in this show is the reason why I think Follies is probably one of the best musicals I have ever seen. And without a doubt, this production is going to rate, I think, among my top 10 shows of all time in London. It's definitely my third number five or five star show this year. Just everybody needs to go. That's all I want for Christmas is more tickets to Follies. I can see this again and again, and it will not stop being enjoyable. What do I have to complain about it? Well, I tell you, the whole story of the couples and the way it ends is not satisfying to me. I think it was building up to something, but I went and did some research and found out that they'd changed the ending from what it was originally for the London production, the original London production, to make it more upbeat. And when you see the ending of the show, it just feel like some they did some audience research, ripped off the last three pages and said, "They don't like this, Bob or Steve. Give them another one." And he came up with some happier ending that was more audience friendly, and they stuck it on, and that's what they stuck with for this show. And I want to find out what that other ending is, because this one does not feel right at all. It just isn't. It is not satisfying. But I'm not going to hold that against this production. It is honestly, it's the last 5 minutes, and the fact that I didn't find this story compelling. Well, you know what? I got straight theater. I can see all the livelong day where I can see, Strindberg and Ibsen and Pinter and whoever else I want to see, and I can get all of that realistic stuff. And you know what? I could use a little bit of fantasy and beauty in my life. And just as Ziegfeld sold it to us, Weissman supposedly sells it to us within this show, and Sondheim sold it to me. I want a little chance to forget about life, especially in a year like this, and Follies is exactly the place I want to go and have a little time to have a dream.
The very old woman is Dame Josephine Bairstow. She's a very experienced opera singer.
She's clearly, you know, beyond her prime, but still so strong. I mean, I was like, I have never seen this woman on stage before, and she just f-ing came in and killed it. Just fabulous. I mean, the fact that we have so much talent in the UK that we can fill a show out that's all leading roles like nothing, that makes me feel so lucky to live here. And I'm glad you went and see it, even though you don't normally go to musicals.
So, Paul, what did you think?
Thanks, Tim. Well, you know, it certainly is a musical extravaganza. And, you know, at various points throughout the piece, you actually in awe of the forces they've put on stage. It looks and sounds terrific. It is a sense of pleasure to listen to this music with a full orchestra, and the way it's been staged is at times very beautiful, particularly in the final climactic sequence of Loveland, which goes for about the last half hour, where the folly of the main characters is presented as a musical extravaganza. And, you know, I guess I'm assuming, because I've never seen the original, you know, having read a little about it, that actually it was meant to contrast a very harsh, bitter reality with the absolute glory and the splendor of this lost musical era. I think ultimately, though, do you care about these four characters? And for me, it really felt like soap opera set to music. And I know that's probably heresy in some people's minds, but actually I was torn by it, because actually I found it musically, you know, luscious, visually beautiful, but, you know, these four characters just go on and on and on. And whether you could care whether who loves who is just, by the end of it, I was like, I didn't care what happened to any of them. I was hoping that maybe the building would open up and collapse on them, given it looked like it was in such a decrepit state. But, you know, having said that, you know, there's those wonderful moments, particularly in the last scene, you know, seeing Jamie D. Hoffman with some dancers singing this extravaganza number. I think, you know, that really came together. I think for me too, musically, it all, although I saw it at a preview, I thought when they did the big number in the middle about who's that woman, for me that was you really showed the potential about what you could do in the Olivier Theatre with this big musical number. And having said that, is it a great musical? I'm not so sure, but it's certainly something that you should probably go and see if you've got any interest in musical theatre, just because it looks expensive. And we may not see something like that on the National anytime soon.
We're now going to talk about Mrs. Orwell, which is being done by the Proud Haddock Theatre Company, and was, for the last month, has been at the Old Red Lion in Islington, and has just moved to the Southwark Playhouse. It has been rather well acclaimed by a lot of critics, and probably deserves this small transfer to the smaller place at the Southwark Playhouse. It concerns George Orwell in 1949. He's got a very severe case of tuberculosis. He wants to plan writing again, and he's fallen for an editor at a magazine that he writes for, and somebody who writes for him. Her name is Sonia. She's 16 years younger than him. She's about 30, and she really loves somebody else. So there is a question of whether or not she wants to marry him, and whether or not she wishes to become Mrs. Orwell. Just as George Orwell is becoming famous, he's written Animal Farm, which was very successful, and this is just after the publication of 1984, which is an acclaimed book. This is a play by Tony Cox, directed by Jimmy Walters, with a design by Rebecca Brower. It has a cast that includes Cressida Bonus, Peter Hamilton Dyer as George Orwell, Rosie Ede, Edmund Digby Jones, and Robert Stocks. Alice, could you tell me more about this play and what you thought of it?
Yes, I have to say that immediately after seeing it, I had some reservations. But thinking about it afterwards, it has lingered in my mind. I thought that this was a very subtle play. At times it was just a bit too subtle for its own good. But at the same time, it did explore quite an underexplored part of literature in drama, and that's about the literary estate. George Orwell is languishing in hospital I think, in a private ward of UCL when the play starts. And as you said, he has fallen for, in fact, he proposes to Sonia Brownell, who is the secretary, well, more than a secretary, is an assistant editor at a magazine to which Orwell, real name Eric Blair, I hasten to add, was a contributor. Now, I said real name Eric Blair because the title of the play is actually Mrs. Orwell. And I think it's quite significant that it is the pseudonym that is the name of the play. It's the pseudonym which is the name which is given to Sonia Brownell when she becomes Mrs. Blair or Mrs. Orwell. And she's very much in this play. She does seem to be defined by the writer George Orwell. She's played by Cressida Bonas. And I think she actually does a very good job of Sonia because it's written as quite a difficult character in that it's almost as if she is the creature of Orwell's imagination. She's very attractive. There's quite a bit of almost still life in a way in between the conversation when she does stand still and look out as if she's some kind of film star. But the play itself is, as I said, it's put together at the time that Orwell was very, very ill. In fact, he was dying. He had been out on a Scottish island with his adopted son, but had been forced to come for treatment to London. A lot of the play involves the business of literature, as I said, and the literary estate. Now, Orwell, of course, or Eric Blair and Sonia moved in a circle of artistic and literary men and women. And this included, of course, his publisher, Fred Warburg. He's played by Robert Stocks, who is very much the businessman. How true to the actual original character of Warburg is a moot point because he was a public schoolboy and Oxford educated and a First World War Army officer. He's not really played like that. He's played more as, I would say, a lower middle class businessman, which again seems to indicate maybe we're seeing things through the filter of Orwell's imagination. I have to say that Orwell himself, it's a totally beguiling performance from Peter Hamilton Dyer, who is quite excitable as Orwell. In the first act, he embodies this public schoolboy enthusiasm. He was Eton educated, but he was also a writer who embodied the values, I think, after the Second World War, which many men, especially coming out of the army, of course, aspired to, of the decent Englishman. And this is the persona that he put over in his essays, especially. Sonia Orwell, it's said, was actually the model for Julia in 1984, who's a slightly jolly hockey sticks sort of person. And I think in some ways she's slightly played like that. It's nothing is made explicit. As I said, sometimes it's a little bit too subtle for its own good. But it's always, always very, very interesting. And I think Tony Cox has actually put together a very clever play. You've also got a performance of a slightly creepy performance, but very charismatic, of the artist Lucian Freud, who may or may not have been in real life a lover of Sonia Brownell. Again, it's a very good performance by Edmund Digby Jones. In some ways, again, his performance and the way that he is presented from the start as being a friend of Orwell, and when in fact I think he actually knew Sonia Brownell earlier, it makes Sonia quite enigmatic. I think really that's the word I'm looking for, that she seems a kind of enigmatic, almost a film star sort of person. But at the same time, it gets a little bit darker in the second act about the business of literature and how she herself was drawn into it. The whole play is very neatly directed by Jimmy Walters, and you've got Jeremy Walmsley's music as well, bridging the scenes. There's a very simple but very effective hospital room design by Rebecca Brower, with a corridor at the back where, in fact, the windows also transform themselves almost into cinema screens. And when some of the action is taking place outside. And this seems quite appropriate because at the time, with the success of especially 1984, Hollywood was becoming very, very interested in George Orwell. And this forms part of the play. And the publisher, Fred Warburg, and also the artist, Lucian Freud, actually have a stake in all this and in making sure that there is somebody there to look after Orwell and also to look after the literary estate. All in all, I think it was very nicely acted, very well directed. There is also a character of the nurse, Rose Ede, which is a bit stereotypical again. But at the same time, there are glimpses of something more, especially in her relationship with Sonia Brownell. And it is a very intriguing play. I have to say my main criticism of it is that there was sometimes quite a bit of name dropping, which was never really elucidated. And actually, I studied Orwell at one time, and I know a little bit about Sonia Brownell. And I know something of what the names meant. And they were part of the plot, but I doubt whether a lot of people who don't have a niche knowledge of these people would understand what was going on at that point. But I think apart from that, it's a play that lingers in the mind. It actually deals with quite a complex subject and brings in quite a lot of aspects about the literary world, about the post-Second World War. Of course, Orwell's book did take off 1984 because in a way it was in the right place at the right time as well, when there was this Cold War zeitgeist and then become a sensation. I think Sonia Brownell, Cressida Bonas, does extremely well. A lot of it with her is visual, but she has got the svelte, cut glass persona. Like Orwell himself, she was actually born in India, although that isn't mentioned, but they are children of empire. I think there is deliberately a vacuum at the center of the play about Sonia Orwell. She remains enigmatic. But as I've tried to say, I think there are reasons for this. And I think on the whole, apart from some of the reservations that I've brought in, it works very, very well.
So, Paul, what did you think of this?
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I had a great time watching Mrs. Orwell at the... I saw it at the old Red Lion Theatre, but it's now transferred to the Southwark Playhouse for a short run. And actually, what's really fascinating is how it does have a cinematic feel as sort of action takes place off stage, but, you know, in a corridor that you can see through because of the ingenuity of the set. But yeah, I really enjoyed actually this whole concept of taking a character who actually, I think, you know, in the years since George Orwell's death, basically Sonia Brownell has been, you know, accused of being a gold digger, all that sort of thing, which would have been quite an achievement since she ended up penniless, I believe, at the time of her death, and portrays her as sort of like this English rose and this woman who actually, you know, was fond of Orwell and actually figured that he didn't have much time to live and might as well cheer him up by getting married to him. So it's a very sympathetic portrayal, but actually what's really lovely is how it captures this period of post-war grimness, because Orwell's just becoming successful and his big book 1984 is just about to be published, and so it's quite a, you know, a fascinating look into both life in London, the harsh realities of that, but also sort of the irony of George Orwell's life is just as he's on the cusp of success, his health is failing him, and how people, you know, rallied around him at the time. And I think For me, that was the interesting thing about this play and how it created this period so well. And I think Cressida Bonas, you know, as Sonia, has this kind of detached but pragmatic beauty about her. And it was quite fun to actually just watch the whole thing, particularly as her interest, you know, moves to other people in the circle as well. So I think, you know, it's a great little production. I think yet again by Proud Haddock, a production company that definitely people should look out for and see what they have got running in the future.
We're now going to talk about 9 to 5, which is a musical, music and lyrics by Dolly Parton with a book by Patricia Resnick, and is based on the 1980 movie of the same name. Dolly Parton, of course, very famously sang the theme song 9 to 5 and also appeared in the movie, so her bringing her own music to it isn't surprising. I think this had a brief run in the West End, but wasn't terribly successful when they put it on. This production is directed by Joseph Hodges, with musical direction by Oliver Hance, choreography by Chris Whittaker. It's about three central women who form a friendship against their rather nasty boss, very memorably played by Dabney Coleman, who's a bit of a favourite in the movie. Gareth, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
The musical adaptation came quite some time after the film, because the film was a 1980 release and the musical adaptation didn't arrive on Broadway until 2009. So it was 29 years later. And it only survived for 4 months on Broadway, which is surprising for me because it seems to me to be very much Broadway material. And actually, we haven't seen it in the West End. It's had some outings that I think a tour has taken it to perhaps Watford and Wimbledon, but it's not actually been in the West End at all. And this is its first Fringe outing, which is also surprising because one might have expected it to be done in somewhere like the Union or the Landor before it met its demise, or up in Walthamstow. So I thought it was very welcome because it gives us a chance to see it, really. Well, those of us interested in musical theatre, anyway. Patricia Resnick, who actually co-wrote the film, provides the book, and as you said, Dolly Parton adds the music and the lyrics. Even though the film was 1980 and the musical was 2009, it's set in 1975, and it tells the story of the ladies of the office of a company called Consolidated Industries. And this CEO, Franklin Hart, is a somewhat obnoxious character. He's corrupt, he's sexist, he's a misogynist. So life is hell under the CEO. And there is a series of events that start with an accidental poisoning, but then move on to the point where he is abducted. And then they are gathering evidence about his corruption to see if they can deal with him. And while they're doing that, they're putting in sort of friendly, family-friendly policies, which was a bit implausible for 1975, to be honest, but there you go. And I honestly don't know why I didn't do better on Broadway, because it's the perfect musical comedy for a New York audience, really. But I can understand more why it didn't make the West End, because I'm not sure, it might be too American for a West End audience. Perhaps it didn't do well in New York because of the feminist message that's in there. The songs are country influenced, obviously, with Dolly Parton writing them, and some particularly funny lyrics, which she's written as well. I think the book's a bit lightweight, but it, you know, it does its job in moving the thing forward. I found the design in this production was functional, but a bit dull. It wasn't particularly attractive to look at. And the choreography was, I think, a bit overdone. A bit over, in fact. They seemed to be trying a bit too hard. Although it had some nice kind of country line dancing references, which I thought were very good. The sound could have been better. The performers were amplified, but the band was really rather loud. And the mix between the two and the positioning of the singers in the space meant you'd, well, I did certainly miss some lyrics and some dialogue because of that, which, you know, for an amplified show in a small theatre is something they should really deal with. The three leads are all very good. Pippa Winslow plays Violet, Amanda Coutts as Judy, and Louise Ollier as Dorothy. I often comment about dodgy wigs, and here we have dodgy wigs, but in this particular case, somehow the dodgy wigs seem wholly appropriate to the material, so I'm not saying it in a negative sense. The baddie, Hart, the CEO, Leo Sene, I think you pronounce it, was a good baddie, but he shouted sometimes when he should have been singing, and I thought that was a bit misguided, really. There's a very nice, young, enthusiastic supporting cast that zip it along, really. So, you know, I think having now seen it, it's not a landmark musical. I'm not sure it's West End material, but it is good fun. It does have some nice songs, and I thought this production, you know, if you're interested in musical theatre, I think this production is a good opportunity to catch it very low cost in a fringe theatre in a decent production. Really, so something I'd recommend for musical theatre lovers, I think.
We're now going to talk about Me and Robin Hood by Sean Dale Jones at the Royal Court Theatre. This is a brief run of a one-man show that he is touring in association with another play of his called The Duke. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It's hard to describe Sean Dale Jones for people who've never seen any of his work. He used to call himself, in a somewhat tongue-in-cheek way, an emerging Welsh artist, even though I think he lives in Cambridge. And he had an alter ego called Hugh Hughes, which he appears to have dropped. But I think the best description would be that he's a storyteller, and his shows are quirky, somewhat off the wall, but charming and often very captivating. And the first one I saw in Edinburgh was called Floating, and it was about the day that Anglesey floated off into the Atlantic Ocean. And I've seen four others since then until this. So this is my sixth show. So you can tell from that I'm quite drawn to his style and his work. This one is a bit more unpredictable than the other shows, and it's also a strip back to just one man and storytelling, and there's no lighting and sound and props and no other characters, because I think four of the five other shows have had other characters on stage, and one of them had sound and lighting that he operated himself, which was the last one that he did at the Royal Court Theatre upstairs, which is in fact the Duke, the one you mentioned, that he's doing some performances of at the Royal Court, although I'm not sure he's doing performances of that on the tour. So this particular story links together his childhood obsession with Robin Hood, the character Robin Hood, and his present-day preoccupation with unfairness, and in particular, the people like Banks have kind of taken over the storytelling role, if you like, that we're all part of their stories now. And the early story takes in his under-11s football team, the relationship between his father and his grandmother, a bit of 70s politics and a sort of bank robbery. And the contemporary story takes in his attempts to protest, arrest, therapy, and his somewhat precarious financial state. And he moves between the two seemingly randomly, although I think it's well-made theatre and it will be rehearsed, and I don't think it is random, but it certainly feels random. The big difference in this show and all the other shows for me, in addition to the unpredictability, was he was genuinely very emotional about both the personal story, the relationship between his grandmother and his father, and also very passionate about the issue that he's talking about today. And I think that sort of very genuine emotion, coupled with some anger and this passion, sometimes makes it uncomfortable, but at the same time, I thought it gave it an awful lot of integrity. So I didn't dislike that, even though sometimes you're sitting there and it's a little bit edgy. I didn't disapprove of that, because I like people who say what they feel, wear their heart on their sleeves. It reminded me a bit of Mark Thomas's shows, Bravo, Figaro and Cuckoo, where he was telling real stories in a sort of combined stand-up stroke theatre mode, really. But he was visibly emotional at times, and it was not faked. You don't really know whether the whole story is true or not. You never know that. I mean, I think a lot of it probably is. I suspect that, you know, there's a fair bit of truth in there. But whether all of it is or not, I don't know, and I'm not sure it matters that much, really, because it is a very effective combination of personal, ethical, political themes all kind of coming together. And one of the things he did with his last show is he didn't charge for the show. It was free at the Royal Court. You just had to buy a ticket. Just had to get a ticket. And then there was a bucket donation for charity as you left the theatre. What he's done this time is he's charged a smaller than usual entrance fee, I think it's £10, and then suggested to you that the average price of the theatre on upstairs would be £17. So you're encouraged to leave the other seven in a bucket as a donation to charity, which is Street Trial United. And if you wish to top that up, then you're clearly invited, if not encouraged, to do so, really. And I like that. I mean, because, you know, the show's called Me and Robin Hood, the character Robin Hood sort of featured in the show, and I think he's trying to make the point here that maybe we should give back a bit here to the poor. So he didn't rob us, certainly not, but he did persuade us to part with some dosh at the end of the evening. And looking at people as they were leaving, you know, a lot of people did that very generously, so I don't think people took offence at that. I mean, he is a true original. There isn't anybody else like Sean Dale Jones. And if you haven't seen him, this is a show, if you can catch it, that's worth catching, because it's sort of, it's him stripped back to the real storytelling experience. And those people who have seen Shaun Dale Jones will know whether they want to go back or not, really. So I won't preach to the converted, but I'd certainly encourage others to have that experience.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azzetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.